This conference is in lecture mode. This conference may be recorded. Joining conference. Your line is unmuted.
Test. Great. I'm gonna hang up on my phone. Does this mean everything is working? All right. Okay. I think we have a green light from the tech team here to get started. I'm gonna convene the House State Affairs Committee meeting at 10:22 a.m. Tuesday, May 19th. A trying start, but I'm sure it's all downhill from here. And I'm going to see at least three other committee members online. Although, if there's anybody else, please chime in or text me. Representative Story, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, terrific. Representative Hopkins?
Yes, I'm here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Is Representative Shaw or Thompson or Vance online? Okay, well, with four members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. The subject today is vote by mail and vote at home, and we're joined by three guests to testify on the subject. As we know, this is of keen interest nationally with COVID-19, and as many know, the state disaster declaration afforded the division of the Alaska, the director of the Alaska Division of Elections, the authority to conduct Alaska's primary and or general elections by mail. The decision was recently made for the primary election to be conducted by mail. So we will be hearing expert testimony to understand what by mail elections might look like, especially in the context of COVID. And in addition, we will be adopting a committee substitute for House Bill 150, which is legislation for my office relating to vote by mail for the state of Alaska. So our order of testifiers is Amber McReynolds from the National Vote at Home Institute, followed by Wendy Underhill from the National Conference of State Legislatures, followed by Barbara Jones from the Municipality of Anchorage. Ms. McReynolds, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Thank you for your patience. If you would please put yourself on record, stating your name and affiliation, and if you could sort of speak to the subject of vote at home in general, but especially in the context of COVID, and at least here in Alaska, there have been sort of concerns surfaced about fraud, and your perspective on those concerns and mitigative measures would be very helpful for the committee and for the public.
Great. Well, thank you for inviting me to provide feedback today, and thank you to the members of the committee for all that you're doing to make sure that elections can happen in a safe and secure way. I think the pandemic has caught many states off guard this year in terms of resiliency within the election systems, and I know that states across the country right now are particularly scrambling to try to make adjustments to make sure that voters do have options. I am the CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, which is a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit. Formerly, I was the director of elections in the city and county of Denver, Colorado, and served as an election official for 14 years. So I come at this as more of a technocrat, where not only did I run elections for many years, but I also transitioned various systems and made not only policy improvements, but also implementation improvements in my former role in Denver. And all of the improvements and different modifications that we were able to make not only improved access, but also improved security, enhanced the way that we were providing the vote by mail and vote at home program, and made Colorado one of the top states to vote in from a customer service perspective, but also from an engagement perspective, and then also as a from a security lens. And that was primarily due to our implementation of various reforms in the process, but also implementation of risk limiting audits. I will also just share by way of knowledge base and expertise, I also served as an advisor on the recent state party run primary election that you all had recently on the Democratic side of the aisle in Alaska that was run by sending out a ballot to everyone and also had a risk limiting audit at the end of that process. So I was approached in a nonpartisan capacity and asked to provide some strategic advice on how that election would be run, and I made various suggestions for that to take place and provided best practices. First and foremost, our organization helps states with policy design and making sure that policies around voting by mail are adopted with best practices in mind, but also to ensure security and accessibility is balanced. And we recently did a 50-state analysis where we essentially analyzed 30 different policy components within each state and that included over 2,000 different metrics and came up with various suggestions by state. First and foremost, with Alaska, a couple of our suggestions include modifying what Alaska currently does with the notary and witness signature requirement to be a signature verification system, which is a best practice that's recommended, especially in the states that predominantly vote by mail. They all utilize a signature verification system that includes bipartisan comparison process, a cure process that notifies voters should there be an issue. And this is an important security measure that goes along with good and robust voting at home systems. The second recommendation that I would have for Alaska specifically is to implement ballot tracking software. And the first ever ballot tracking system was actually created when I was in Denver, and we created it as a city to provide a ballot tracking solution that is just like you would have for a package, like that you track through FedEx or that you order online and it gets delivered through UPS or one of the other systems. You'd be able to track your ballot in the same way. You'd have visibility from the moment it's been printed or when it goes out for delivery to you, and then all the way on the back end, you get a confirmation that your ballot was received and processed by your county election official. And that's an important accountability tool that also has enhanced security. It's part of the reason that we implemented it in Denver. And then it's been rolled out in various states across the country, including the latest being California. And there's a few different vendors and entities that support that type of technology. The next piece that I would recommend is providing an online way for voters to request an absentee ballot. So making sure that that portal is accessible and making sure that voters have an ability to request that ballot online if you're not mailing one to everyone. And the important thing there is that's more efficient for the voters, but it also provides a more seamless administrative process for election officials. The fifth piece is prepaying postage for envelopes, and this again is a best practice, but it also just eliminates the question marks that voters might have in their heads about getting the ballot back and what that might look like. So it just streamlines the process, and it also enhances security so that you don't have voters, you know, they have that option to mail it back or they could drop it off themselves, but it also gives them more options as voters and not rely on somebody else or another entity to figure that out for them. Increasing options for ballot return. So in addition to offering the prepaid postage, we recommend offering 24x7 drop boxes, maybe at current city or state structures, city halls, rec centers, libraries. Those are all good practices in various states, and we recommend making sure that there's drop-off options because a lot of voters like to drop that ballot off in person, and it preserves their ability to do so. And then finally, making sure that there's a good replacement ballot process. So if a voter moves and doesn't get their ballot, making sure they have a way to resolve that, and then ending the entire election process with risk-limiting audits. We believe this is the gold standard, and it's been proven to be the gold standard in auditing by security experts across the country, and We just conducted the primary that you all just had an RLA at the end of it, a risk limiting audit at the end of it, and it went very well. And I think it's a testament to, again, adopting that type of best practice. So in summary, we're grateful to be to provide feedback and happy to answer questions and provide additional resources. Our website is voteathome.org, and we do have a number of research studies, analysis, best practices, resources for election officials, all located on that website for your use as well. So thank you for having me.
Thank you very much, Ms. McReynolds. Going through the points that you highlighted, signature verification, ballot tracking software, an online portal for sort of requesting, I guess, one's ballots, prepaid postage, risk limiting audits. Did I miss a point or two in your recommendations?
So just to review, signature verification, the second piece, cure process, third being the ballot tracking solution, fourth being the online request process, fifth, prepaid postage for return envelopes, sixth, increasing options for ballot returns, so doing the drop boxes, seventh being the risk limiting audits, and eight being the replacement ballot piece.
Great, thank you. And I believe those are all in the CS that we'll consider later today, but thank you for laying them out. Representatives Story, Hopkins, or Fields, any questions for Ms. McReynolds?
This is Hopkins. Not on my end, sorry. Thank you.
Yes, this is Representative Story. Some of the concerns I've heard from some residents is voter fraud. And could you just explain a little bit more of perhaps just the implementation of the signature verification and the tracking software, just a little bit more how that works?
Sure. With signature verification, the way that it works is you would sign on the affidavit on the envelope. So the states do this differently, but essentially there's an affidavit, and you sign that on the envelope. That envelope comes back into the election official, and that signature that you provide on that envelope is compared to the signature that is on file that you may have provided when you got your driver's license or state ID, or when you registered to vote, or when you voted in person. So any of those kind of documents that get collected and get scanned into the system, we can essentially compare the signature of record to the signature on the envelope, and that helps us create a match to make sure that you were the one that completed that ballot. And there's various ways that this can be done. There is actually equipment that has signature verification software built in, where it looks at, you know, it looks at the reference signature, compares the other, and makes a match within a certain criteria. Or there's the manual way, which you can have basically bipartisan teams of election judges manually review those and compare those signatures and make a determination if there's a match. I like the sort of software first process, where you would essentially have equipment scan that, because it's a little bit faster and more efficient. And then any of the equipment can't match, you could have election judges compare manually and make that determination. Then if that signature doesn't match, and the best practice is that you have bipartisan agreement that it should be rejected. So in Colorado, for instance, it must be a Republican and a Democrat both saying that the signature doesn't match for then the rejection to occur. That rejection triggers what's called a cure letter. And in that cure letter, you as a voter get immediately notified either via text, via email, with a post letter that your signature did not match, and you have to respond and cure that, meaning you have to basically confirm that you did in fact return the ballot and provide a copy of your ID with that cure letter back into the office. And the way that that comes back in is you can either have the voter email it. You can also, there's a text secure platform, which a lot of jurisdictions use, or you can give them a prepaid envelope and they can return the affidavit into the office. And then you, normally the best practice is to allow 8 to 10 days post-election for when for that cure process to happen, so that if a voter does get rejected, they have basically a window of time post-election day to cure that and make sure that their ballot gets counted.
And I just want to jump in. Senator Reinbold has briefly joined us, it should be noted. A follow-up question, Representative Story?
Oh, yes. Thank you for that explanation. And then just about tracking software, could you explain that too, please?
Oh, yes, sure. I didn't get to that part. So the ballot tracking software is designed to basically provide the voter end-to-end accountability of where their ballot is, and it's also a great tool for election administrators because they on the back end can also track the ballot through the postal process. And so what's great about it is the way that it works is really on the envelope, again, we basically apply what's called an intelligent mail barcode, and that's provided. There's a service for that through the United States Post Office. The print vendor that mails and prints the ballots would apply that intelligent mail barcode on both the outgoing and the return envelope. And so when then the ballots get dropped off at the post office or at the postal facility, when they scan that, they then basically you'll get a message saying the post office has received your ballot that will be coming to you. You as a voter get that message, and then the election officials can also, on the back end, in that type of system, verify that all of the ballots, for instance, that they gave to the post office were in fact scanned and are out for delivery. And then there, depending on the postal process and sort of where the ballots are going, there might be an additional scan to say, okay, now it's out with your carrier. So you might even get the specific level that it's with your carrier for delivery to you on a certain day. And then all of that happens on the back end. So then when you put your ballot in the return envelope, again, when the post office gets that ballot for processing, once that barcode gets scanned, a message is triggered to you to say, the post office has processed your ballot and it's on its way back to the election official. So you get that message. Then you get a final message when your election official has, you might even get two final messages, but your election official has received it. You'll get a message saying your ballot's been received by your county official. And then finally you'll get a message saying that your ballot's been accepted, meaning the signature has been verified. And if something goes awry with the signature, that system will also immediately notify the voter via text or email that they have an issue and they've got to click a link, for instance, to resolve that issue with the affidavit. The other notices that a tracking system like that can provide, for instance, is if the voter moves and doesn't update their address, they might get a message saying the ballot was, you know, we sent the ballot out, but it came back undeliverable because you've moved. You need to update your address, and it will give the voter that kind of information. So the ballot tracking system, it provides voters that direct accountability, just like when you're, you know, order something online and it's coming to you, but also it gives election officials that ability on the back end to track everything. And if a voter calls and says that they have an issue or that kind of thing, the election official can immediately see where that issue came. Up to this point and without that type of ballot tracking system, election officials and voters alike just don't have that visibility into that process. All you know is that you mailed it at the post office, and then you don't really know anything beyond that. So this just adds all of this accountability, which enhances security.
Thank you, Ms. McReynolds. Representative Hopkins, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you were doing this, I believe you said it was in Colorado, I believe. What was the rate of signatures that were not accepted or understood? Do you have a percentage rate of how many of those that was? Because we have obviously exceedingly slow mail here in Alaska and wanted to know how many people that might cause a problem for and things like that.
It's a very small number, to be honest with you. I think on average when I was in Denver, it usually was about 0.5%. And what we also did as a state, which I would recommend, and it's really important, is to develop standards and training for statewide, meaning every county goes through the same process and there's consistency for the standards that you apply for doing that, and then all the election judges essentially get the same training. That's really important because what we don't want to see is, for instance, one county to have 4% or something and another county have, 0.5%, right? In theory, the way that it works is there should be consistency. And so that consistency of training and policies and procedures is really important. But 0.5% is usually around what it is. And the cure rate varies, meaning how many of those get cured and how many people respond to that. It tends to vary by the race and how close it might be. So I'll put that out there. If it's a blowout in a particular election, we might not see as many people cure. But usually, because we've made the cure process easier and there's lots of ways to cure, it can be about 50% or so of those that get cured. And then what I would say about it, I don't think we'd ever want, or we likely wouldn't have 100%, because since it is a security measure, some of those that don't get cured are by design. It basically means the system caught something that shouldn't be. Maybe someone moved into a house and, the other person was no longer there and they voted that ballot. Whatever that kind of activity might be, we need to catch that. And so sometimes it's inappropriate. Situation where there isn't a cure because the voter didn't provide that ballot back and the system catches that. And then in that instance, if there is a situation where the voter hasn't responded, any of those left over that are not cured are reviewed by law enforcement or district attorneys post-election to make sure there's not any criminal type issues. And that's really rare, but there have been some, and again, that's something that safeguards the system and make sure that we hold any bad actors that might try to do anything wrong accountable.
Thank you for that answer. Representative Fields, do you have a question?
I do. The Alaska Division of Elections has said that for the primary, they're going to proceed with an in-person election. As you probably know, we have a no-excuse absentee or vote-at-home ballot process. So my question is there any technical or procedural reason that the Division of Elections couldn't be a little bit more proactive about getting ballots out to people so that they can vote at home while still maintaining the capacity to vote in person?
Well, here's what I would say. When we wrote our laws in Colorado and restructured how we were delivering elections, It was for a few reasons, but number one, voters were increasingly asking for vote by mail ballots. And so we looked at it and said, well, given this trend, we should be delivering this in a more efficient way, frankly. So there's a couple different ways that they could do that. If you went so far as doing a Colorado style of reform, that would entail mailing a ballot to every elector while still preserving in-person voting options, but at what we call vote centers, meaning you can go to any of the voting center locations. You're not constricted to only one polling place. And the reason that I really like that model because it cut down on our provisionals and sort of voters showing up to the wrong polling location if they moved, but also in a pandemic where we're seeing polling place changes and adjustments happening sometimes really late, providing vote centers is a better way to do it because you basically equip each of those centers to serve any voter. And so if there are last-minute polling place changes or reductions or those sorts of things, it makes the process more resilient for those last-minute changes to occur. Sending a ballot to everyone is, for the size of Alaska, for instance, the way that I would go about doing that is to contract with a vendor, a third-party vendor, to provide that service for the entire state. And there's actually a similar model right now in Rhode Island, for instance. The state actually coordinates and sends out the ballots for every single local locality.
And Maryland does something similar, and they're doing that now. And it's actually more efficient to do that because you can essentially make all the envelopes the same design for the entire state. You're realizing economies of scale and making that more efficient for the localities and taking some of that manual burden off of the local jurisdictions from having to do all of that. So that's one of the suggestions I would make for that. And then if they're not going to send a ballot to every voter automatically, I think it would be wise to at least educate the public in a broad way. Maybe that's sending out an application to every single elector so that they have that proactively, or sending them some sort of communication where they know they can sign up for vote by mail. That's happening right now in states like Michigan. They've decided to send an application to every voter. Georgia just did that. Kentucky is doing something along those same lines. So a lot of states are taking that. If they're not going to send a ballot, they at least send the application, which can make that easier.
Thank you, Ms. McReynolds. I had a question about the signature verification. You referred to, you know, signatures being on file and those signatures then being compared to the signature on a returned ballot. Are there issues at all with the sort of data quality or fidelity of signatures that might be on file? I guess in other words, is it reasonable to assume most states, including say Alaska, would have these signatures in an appropriate format and an appropriate quality that would allow for us to build a vote at home or vote by mail election system on that signature data?
Yeah, so most states right now, and I don't know exactly how Alaska handles this, but most states, and this is a best practice, is to most, pretty much every document that would come in, whether it be a voter registration application, an absentee ballot application, or an in-person signature card, or even a mail ballot in the outside of that, or the driver's license signatures, all those things are housed and kept and scanned into the voter registration system, and they're kept as part of that voter file. So you might have, you know, you might have 30 signatures for different things that you've signed associated with that. So there should be that, because that tends to be what most states do. Also, a way that other states have filled that gap is if they don't have a lot of signatures on file, they enter into a memorandum of understanding with the department that runs motor vehicle offices, and they can consume those image files from motor vehicle and add them into the voter registration database. It's usually not a difficult technical process to do that, because you're really just uploading imagery into the system. But again, I don't know the specifics on the Alaska, you know, kind of the back end of the system, but in theory, they should be able to do that relatively easily, because they're also currently doing that for other types of transactions.
Thank you. And I should note that we invited the Lieutenant Governor's Office and the Division of Elections to participate in today's hearing, although that opportunity was declined. But hopefully we can figure out, get an answer to the sort of lay of the land in terms of signature data. I think Representative Fields is good on questions, but Representative Hopkins or Story, any further questions for Ms. McReynolds?
None here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
None here either. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I think at this point, Ms. McReynolds, we really appreciate your time and patience as we got this hearing on track. So we will move to the next testifier on the agenda. Although I think at this moment in time, just because the telephonic nature of things and people being in motion with the sine die of legislative session having just happened, I want to entertain a motion to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 150. Representative Hopkins, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House State Affairs Committee adopt committee substitute HB 150, number 31-LS0311/M, as in mother, as the working document.
Thank you. And Representative Story or Fields, any objection to the motion to adopt the CS for House Bill 150? Hearing none, The motion to adopt the CS for House Bill 150 is adopted, and I will note that this committee substitute for House Bill 150 is modeled after the Colorado system, which includes all the provisions that Ms. McReynolds testified to. There's some adaptations for Alaska, and it's my intent through the course of this year to parse through this language and continue to refine and improve the substance of this legislation, so that we're creating basically an optimal policy document that the legislature will be positioned to act on in the future. So this covers our business with House Bill 150. I next want to move to Wendy Underhill with the National Conference for State Legislatures in Colorado. Ms. Underhill, are you online and can you hear us?
Yes, I am here and I hear you fine.
Ah, great. Thank you so much for joining us and making the time. If you could please put yourself on record and state your affiliation, and we'd be really grateful to hear your perspective and sort of expertise in terms of how different states and legislatures around the country are navigating COVID vis-a-vis COVID, and sort of measures that they are taking to protect public health while still ensure the seamless administration of elections.
Absolutely. I'm Wendy Underhill, and I'm the Director of Elections and Redistricting at the National Conference of State Legislatures, and it is my honor to be here with you today, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. NCSL is the nation's bipartisan organization that serves the needs of legislators and legislative staff throughout the nation and the territories. We're headquartered in Denver, which means I'm a Colorado voter, which means I have personal experience with some of the voting that Amber just described. So if I may, I'll just go, you might say, off script for a moment and tell you that of two experiences I've had as a voter here. And one is that my daughter at the age of 16 registered or pre-registered to vote when she was in high school. And she had a nice signature with nice rounded letters and every letter distinct. Then when she went to vote her first time after she had turned 18, she had changed her signature into a slash. And sure enough, that signature cure process caught that, and we were notified that there was a problem with her signature and given the opportunity to fix it. So I was pleased to see that that process actually worked. And then the second one is that I had the opportunity to sign up for ballot tracking, and that meant that I gave my phone for text purposes to our local election official. So I get a text that says, your ballot's been printed. And then I get a text that says, your ballot is ready to go in the mail. Your ballot has been received by the Postal Service. And it goes on until the final one says, your ballot has been received and has been accepted here at the local election office, and you will not hear from us again until the next election comes around. So that, I hope, puts a little color on some of what we had. Then I just wanted to now return to my formal remarks. So NCSL's work is informational, and that means we do not offer advice on policy matters that come before state legislatures. We do lobby sometimes in Washington at the federal level. Instead, we provide a 50-state perspective on key topics, and in the elections world, there seems to be just one topic right now, and that is how to conduct elections in a manner that is safe for voters and for poll workers in light of coronavirus. All states are making adjustments to their election processes because of the virus, and that's in large part because voters are making adjustments to how they choose to vote. This spring, and probably for at least the next few months, or as long as COVID-19 appears to be a risk, voters will be deciding for themselves if they want to make use of absentee voting or vote by mail to avoid going to a polling place. Reports have shown a dramatic increase in these options in the states that have held elections since mid-March. So as the voters have shifted, states are shifting. We often think of states as setting policy and then the voters follow along, but here I think it's the other way around. That means that states are faced with a need to scale up their existing processes or to adopt new processes in record time. Mostly those shifts have come through the executive branch so far, and yet legislatures are where election policy is generally created. After getting through the first shocks of COVID-19, we're now beginning to see legislatures take the lead again, such as you're doing here in Alaska. In fact, I'd say that you were at the front end of that wave. So I've taken the actions that states have adopted so far and put them into four different categories or buckets. These categories are not mutually exclusive, and indeed many states are doing more than one of these. The first is that 18 states have postponed primary elections or some kinds of elections. Most of these were the elections that were scheduled in April and May, and they'll now be taking place in June or July. Of these postponements, the majority were presidential or state primaries, but a few states have also delayed state primary runoff or municipal elections. Alaska was not part of that postponement trend because its state primary is late in the season. I believe it's August 18th, and there's only six states that hold their state primary any later than Alaska does. So the second bucket is that a number of states are making it easier for voters to request an absentee ballot, which in essence is a way to encourage mail voting without having to make a sweeping policy change or to enact new laws. And this category can take several forms. For instance, of the 16 states that require voters to provide an excuse to get an absentee ballot, about half have declared that fear of COVID-19 is an acceptable reason under their laws. And then 11 states have taken the novel step of mailing absentee ballot applications to all registered voters for primary elections. Amber mentioned that Michigan has just announced that as of this morning. And with this decision to send a ballot application out, it remains the voter's responsibility to request the ballot according to whatever the existing state law is. But it is a way for a state to nudge a voter in that direction and increase the number of or the percentage of ballots that are going to be cast by mail. In fact, mailing an absentee ballot application can be seen as a middle ground between running elections as usual and moving to mostly mail elections, which will be the third of my four categories, and I'll get there in just a moment. To send applications out to all voters does require resources, but there's reason to think that coronavirus will make elections more expensive this year, no matter what decisions are made. There's one way or another, it's going to cost more probably this year. And the application mailing itself may serve to both give election officials new information for list maintenance purposes and to ensure that only those people who want a mail ballot will have one sent to them when the election time itself arrives. Another way to make it easier for a voter to get an absentee ballot is to create an online portal for the application process. And again, Amber did mention this. It's a bit like online voter registration, and in some states, the two systems are interlinked. And if you have an absentee ballot request portal, a voter can request a mail ballot without exchanging a paper form with a local election official. After the portal is set up, a portal is expected to reduce the cost of managing absentee ballots because no mailing is required, and processing times for each request will be much reduced when compared with managing a paper application. Also, human error will be reduced as well. I know of four states that have either created online portals or announced plans to do so in the last couple of months. And I'm pretty sure that brings the total up to 14 states that are providing this avenue, and I'm expecting we may see more of that as we go forward. And before I move on to the third category, I'd just like to mention that NCSL has a web report called Voting Outside the Polling Place that outlines many of the policy choices I'm touching on today and that any of the questions that might come up when looking at increased absentee or mail voting. I'm happy to share that with you electronically if you like. Okay, in the third category, it's mailing ballots, not just ballot applications, to all voters. Five states already had this standard operating procedure before COVID-19 hit. I used to refer to these as the all-mail election states, and now I'm calling them the mostly mail election states, because even when ballots are sent out to all registered voters, states still maintain some kind of election day operation, such as vote centers, to assist voters who haven't received their ballot or have any other kinds of voting issues. Also works for same-day registration and for anyone who's moved within the jurisdiction and needs to update their registration. So with a polling place operation of some kind, like a vote center, and mail elections, I think we could think of this as a hybrid election. There's some absentee, some in person, and it's just a question of where the bulk of the votes come in. So in addition to those original five states with mostly mail elections, this month the governor of California has, by executive order, directed that November's election be conducted by mailing out ballots to all voters while maintaining vote centers, as we've just discussed. So that kind of makes six states, but I haven't really put California in the same bucket with the others because it isn't law going on forward into the future. And then after this primary season, Montana's governor issued a directive that gave all counties the authority to decide if they'd like to conduct this year's state primary by mail, and all counties did opt to do so. That election takes place next week, June 2nd. And since COVID-19, Maryland, Nevada, and New Jersey have all moved to a mostly mail primary as well. Two more states to mention here, and those are Nebraska and North Dakota, along with California, who until I just told you has moved to mostly mail for this year. But prior to this, those three states allowed counties to decide on their own if they'd like to conduct any of their elections by mail. And for its May primary, 10 of Nebraska's counties used mail, and North Dakota's governor signed a directive strongly encouraging counties to do so for the primary. And if we were to look at all these states that I've just talked about on a map, you'd see that there's a geographic trend. These are mostly western states. New Jersey and Maryland changed that story a little bit, but until they came on board, it was very much a western phenomenon. Mostly voters have been pleased to have the option to vote at home, but not all people feel the same way, of course. And in fact, there may be some categories of voters who are disadvantaged by mail voting. One of these groups is Native Americans, and whether that extends to Alaskan Natives as well, I don't know. Other groups who may not be easily served by mail voting are people who move often, people experiencing homelessness, anyone with low literacy, and some people with disabilities. In that last category, of course, each disability is unique, and some people with disabilities may prefer voting at home where they can use their own technology and it may be just exactly the right thing, but others may need the opportunity to go into a polling place where accessible voting equipment is available. Just something to keep in mind. Now I'd like to turn to the reasons that more states aren't likely to move to mostly mail elections this year. The first is that making the shift can be hard to do depending on what a state's voting process looks like at this moment. In other words, if many people are already voting by mail, then processes are in place that can probably be scaled up. But if voting by mail is still a very small portion of all voting, then scaling up presents some challenges. In the states that have moved to mostly mail elections, they've gotten there over the course of years with policies that have been encouraging mail voting, such as creating a permanent absentee voting list. And I understand in Alaska, you've gone to the point where a voter only has to ask once and be able to receive mail ballots for the whole year, any elections that come up in that whole year. And then as states are preparing to go to more mail, I've just highlighted four topics they might want to be sure to address. And the first is what Amber talked about, the signature on the outside of the return envelope. Is it checked against signatures on file? The second is it possible to begin to process these ballots, even though not count them, before Election Day? If not, there could be a huge pile of ballots that arrive on Election Day, and everyone will be sorting and opening and scanning, and results could be delayed. Is there a way for a voter to be contacted? This is like my daughter with a bad signature. If there's a problem with the signature, can they fix it? And then the last thing I'll offer is that candidates and campaign managers very much appreciate it if mail ballots can be reported at the precinct level and not only reported at an aggregate level. That way they'll know more precisely where their voters can be found. That helps with their campaigning. Okay, so that's three categories. The last one is very short, and I'm close to done. It is that all states are striving to make polling places safer. For voter safety, new measures range from moving from touchscreen machines to using paper ballots. That's what's happened in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, to giving every voter their own pen to vote with in Nebraska, to working out the details of drive-through voting in Conway, New Hampshire, and also Bristol, Virginia. And, of course, all kinds of enhanced health measures are being used, such as marking 6 feet intervals for voters who are waiting in line, providing poll workers with masks and gloves, and disinfecting just about anything and everything very frequently. And I'll just offer one more comment, and that is that the maintenance of high voter confidence in our election processes is very important. So anything states can do to assure voters that their votes are going to be counted correctly, regardless of how the ballots are delivered to the voter or delivered back to the election official, is really great. And that means voter education this year may be more important than it ever has been before. And with that, I thank you for this opportunity to be here. I'm happy to take questions now or at any time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Underhill, for the testimony. Representative Fields, a question.
Thanks. Appreciate the list of states, and Montana jumped out at me because of the similarities with Alaska. And I just was wondering if you could speak to the transition time for the counties in Montana that went to a primarily vote-at-home system. How did the respective divisions of election implement that? What was the timeline? And, of course, I'm thinking about our primary later this summer and the steps that the division of elections is going to have to take here if they wanted to make it easier for people to vote at home.
Thank you, Representative Fields. I know just a couple of things, and one is that election officials, which are county clerks in Montana, have been favoring moving to mostly mail elections for some time, and that so they have been, first of all, encouraging people to choose to vote by absentee ballots or mail ballots over the course of years. So the percentage of voters that are doing so in Montana is already pretty high amongst the states. And so they have processes in place. Beyond that, I'm not sure I can give you any details. That's something I'd be happy to check with the state election director in Montana on and share some thoughts back on that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Story or Hopkins, any questions for Ms. Underhill?
Hi, yes, this is Rep. Story. I was wondering, you had mentioned disadvantaged, some groups are disadvantaged for voting by mail. Do you have any suggestions or have states put any mechanisms in play to help alleviate that?
Yes, thank you for that question. Having some amount of in-person voting is probably the best way to work with that situation so that there is a place for people to go to vote on election day if there are questions about their whether they got a ballot at their last address, whether they have an address. Any problems can be handled in a in-person way on election day. And each of those groups is unique, of course, and even within those groups, the needs might be different, but voter education here, too, can help. And working with people who you might think of as either advocates for or leaders in these communities could be useful. For instance, those who work in shelters for people experiencing homelessness might be able to be a conduit for good information for those folks. And certainly tribal leaders in Indian country can help set up a system that will work for their voters.
Thank you.
Thought for you there.
Representative Hopkins, any questions for Ms. Underhill?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And I have a follow-up question along the lines of Representative Story's question. For in Indian country specifically, how or why is it that there are sort of concerns about sort of enfranchisement, I guess, or sort of access to voting by mail, voting at home in Indian country?
I'll give you the best I've got. I wrote a blog post about this a couple of years ago, and it really stuck in my mind. And so just working off the top of my head, I'll offer that primarily, well, there's a number of things. One of them is that oftentimes addresses are not handled the same on a reservation as they are elsewhere, and most people receive their mail at post office boxes instead of at a box at their house. And that's a problem because there aren't enough postal boxes, so several families might be sharing one postal box. So then when you get there, is your ballot still waiting for you? In places such as Arizona, where the Navajo Reservation is, people often live many, many miles away from their post box and might only get into town to get their mail once or twice a month. And on some parts of the year, the roads are impassable, and so getting your ballot can be tricky. So there are ways to work on the addressing. North Dakota has worked on this to some extent so that you can have a way to identify something that doesn't have a street and a number but would literally be geographic, look at a map and point to where the house is. That is possible to do, and I could get you more information on that piece. But the part about being able to access your mail is a little trickier. And then, at least speaking for Navajo, the Navajo Reservation, voting has often been a community day, perhaps with being taken place at the tribal headquarters, possibly with a party to go along with it. And so there's a cultural piece there as well. And depending on what Native American group we're talking about, there could be literacy problems in English. People might be, of course, fluent in Navajo or other languages, but not necessarily as fluent in English. So low literacy comes into play there as well.
Thank you very much. I think there's all parallels to the Alaska Native community here, and I mean, certainly in the villages in my district, basically physical street addresses are don't exist or are kind of an inside joke. I really appreciate that perspective, and I'll be sure to look up that blog post. Just with a late start, it's my intent to make sure we adjourn no later than 11:30, and that's 11:30 Alaska time for our non-Alaskan listeners and testifiers. So I'm going to move on to Barbara Jones, the municipality of Anchorage. Ms. Jones, thank you very much for making the time today. Would you be able to put yourself on record and state your affiliation, as well as sort of share Anchorage's experience adopting a vote-at-home policy, and also speak to the extent to which any of the infrastructure that Anchorage has developed and built out is sort of cross-applicable or could serve the state of Alaska's needs for a statewide election were that called upon or asked for?
Certainly. Thank you very much, Representative. My name is Barbara Jones. I'm the Anchorage Municipal Clerk and our election administrator. A couple of things. I'm not sure I'm going to get to remember all of those questions, so let me just say a few things, and then if you could follow up with questions. The Anchorage Assembly established Vote by Mail in Anchorage in 2016, and the reason was that Vote by Mail was a strategy to increase voter turnout and empower Anchorage residents. So what happened from 2016 until we implemented Vote by Mail in 2018? There are three things that I'm going to tell you about that we did in those years. And the first one was get some requests from proposals, and there are three key functions. So that does go to your question about what are the systems that we have. The first one was the mail sorter and signature verification system. The second one was the ballot scanning and tabulation system. And the third one was a printing and mailing vendor. So that took up probably the largest bulk of the time, getting the request for proposals done, making sure that we did them right. The second thing was we leased an updated functional secure space, and the third thing was we updated the municipal code. So, and of those things, you asked which, if any of those, could the state of Alaska use. And interestingly, the state of Alaska has the exact same ballot scanning and tabulation system that the municipality of Anchorage does. The state has some type of a mail sorter system. I don't know enough about that. It is different than ours. The signature verification system that we use ingests signatures from the state of Alaska voter registration database. So, again, I don't know the exact relationship, but I do believe that the state may have that capacity. For our printing and mailing system, we do submit the voter info that we get from the State of Alaska Voter Registration Database and assign a unique ballot package ID to each voter to our printing and mailing vendor. And they're the one that print, inserts, and mails the ballot packages from their secure facility to each registered voter in Anchorage. That system is something, again, that I don't know what the state's capacity is for that. So just a quick overview. I kind of talked to you a little bit about the beginning of what Vote by Mail looks like in Anchorage, and it's very similar to what your prior two speakers talked about Vote by Mail in other Western jurisdictions like Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Utah. So we provide that information that we get from the state to our printing and mailing vendor who mails a ballot package to every registered voter. We accept the return ballot envelopes by mail through the secure drop boxes. We have 18 secure drop boxes in Anchorage. And also at our vote centers, we've had 6 in the past. This year, due to COVID-19, we only had 1. We run them through our mail sorter, which checks for duplicates, ID required, or other issues with the envelope. We verify the signature on the envelope against the signatures in the State of Alaska voter registration system. After signature verification, we open the envelopes and separate the ballots in a confidential manner, as we've done and the state does with absentee by mail envelopes. We've done that for 40 years. After the envelopes are separated from the ballots are separated from the envelopes, we run them through the high-speed scanners and then tabulate the numbers on election night and report the results. And that is the same system that the state has. So that kind of gives you an idea of why we moved to vote by mail, what the significant tasks were from 2016 to 2018 implementation, and what vote by mail looks like in Anchorage. And I can answer any questions that I didn't get to.
Thank you very much. I'll just open up with a quick question. Has the municipality of Anchorage experienced any fraud associated with its vote by mail vote at home system?
Well, I think that is that's a difficult question because, and I think your prior speakers both mentioned this, Anchorage does have a cure process. And so what happens if someone has a signature that doesn't match? They get a cure letter. Our code requires us to send a cure notification within 3 days of processing the envelope. And so it is true that our statistics are very similar to the ones that Ms. McReynolds mentioned, and we do have about a 50% cure rate, but there are some envelopes that were not cured, and I have never heard before what she said, that maybe they shouldn't be cured. We have had a couple of envelopes in the past that we have discussed with the municipal attorney where we have had concerns. I think one of those was at a vote center, so it was not vote by mail. It was a live situation. We reported that to the Anchorage Election Commission. They asked us to move forward with that. And a second one was a vote by mail situation where it appeared that a senior voted both senior and junior's mailed ballot envelopes that were sent to the same address. So those are the only two situations that I've had, but I report those to the assembly every year. We've had a couple of more, but most of them, for example, this year we had a couple of votes that said voted by Facebook Live, and I presume that's due to COVID-19. We've never seen that before. That's an invalid signature, and it was rejected for lack of signature. But we don't believe that that's fraud.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Questions from Representative Story, Hopkins, or Fields for Ms. Jones?
This is Zach. I do have a question. Ms. Jones, thanks for your work to implement Vote at Home in Anchorage. It's pretty extraordinary how successful it's been, and my question is, if you know, you were put in a position of moving to a primarily Vote at Home system while maintaining in-person capacity at vote centers for the state of Alaska for the summer primary, what are some of the first things that you would do based on your knowledge of the state's system to make Vote at Home as successful as possible? Thank you.
Through the chair, Mr. Fields, are you asking me to say what I would do to implement vote by mail or vote at home in the state?
Sure. Just in general, having gone through this experience in Anchorage, and based on your experience in Anchorage, you know, what are some of the first things that you think the state should look at doing to make Vote at Home more accessible? Would it be proactively mailing ballots out to people? What are some other steps? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Fields, I think the answer to that is a couple of things. Number one, some of your speakers have already told you it's to mail absentee by mail applications to every registered voter. I think that is how people get to make a choice if they want to vote at home this year. Number two, one of the things that Anchorage did was send a postcard out to voters to make sure that we had their correct mailing address. So that is one of the things that your prior speakers talked about, is sometimes those addresses need updating. And when people go to polling locations, their address doesn't really matter. So that's another step that you might want to consider. And then a third step that you might want to consider, and this is maybe a more long-term process, and I think one of your prior speakers mentioned that you can register to get an absentee ballot this year, and you'll get one for the primary and the general election. You can request one for both elections. Seems to me that it would be really nice if I knew that I was going to be in Florida every November or Arizona because I'm a snowbird, that I should be able to request that absentee by mail ballot to be permanently mailed to me. So a permanent absentee list could be really helpful to voters. So those are the steps that I think probably need to start the process and really make it easier for Alaska voters to vote at home.
Thank you. And just to jump in on that last point, there was legislation this last session looking to establish a permanent absentee by mail setup. I don't believe it made its way through the process, but that recommendation is very much noted. And sorry to jump in. Representative Fields, did you have a follow-up? It doesn't seem so. Representative Hopkins or Story, any questions for Ms. Jones?
None here, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes, this is Rep. Story. I have heard that our closed and party-run primary system can make this, and I know right now, and I'm just talking about from your perspective, and I know we decided, or Lieutenant Governor decided not to do the primary vote by mail right now, but can you elaborate on why that might be more difficult with our closed and party-run primary system?
Through the chair, I'm sorry, I really can't. The municipality of Anchorage is nonpartisan, so that is not an issue for me. I can tell you that in our research and on our trips to the lower 48, we know that other jurisdictions do primaries by vote by mail, and we visited Thurston County in, I believe that was in Washington, and I would recommend that you contact them to get more information about how to do a vote by mail primary.
Thank you.
Ms. Jones, I was wondering how much did turnout change in percentage terms before and after adoption of a vote at home election system?
Mr. Chair, I think that we're doing pretty good. Our turnout was in the high teens to low 20s, and it is now at in the low 30s or low 20s. There are two things that I think are driving that. I do think that vote at home is easier for folks, and we're seeing a bump because of that. In addition, I would tell you, if you look at those numbers, our voter registration is much larger. We have 232,000 registered voters in Anchorage, which is about, it's pretty close to 100% of our adult population. So we think that the voter registration numbers are a little bit high right now. People haven't notified the state that they've moved or don't live here anymore. So we think our turnout is probably a little bit better than that, but I'd say it's probably a good 5 to 10% bump.
Got it. So a 5 to 10% increase, and I realize that permanent fund dividend automatic voter registration, you know, took effect in that same time. So just in maybe in absolute terms, what how many ballots were being cast in municipal elections before vote at home and after vote at home?
That is a great question, Mr. Chair. So the number was probably around 50,000, and we are in the high 70s now. We hit 79,000 in 2018, and this year we were at about 72.
That's really exciting to hear. Thank you. Great. And I just one other follow-up question. So it sounds like the quality of signatures in the state of Alaska's voter registration database was sufficient to administer the signature verification process. Is that an accurate conclusion?
Mr. Chair, that is a very accurate conclusion. I will tell you that the signatures are excellent. When we have signatures that we don't have a reference signature in the state of Alaska voter registration database in the data that we've downloaded, we contact the state of Alaska. We have a wonderful partnership with them. I don't have the exact number for 2020, but in 2019, we contacted the state for a number of signatures that we didn't have on file. Some of those signatures are on microfiche, so those are not in the database that's accessible. But the state of Alaska partnered with us. They found those signatures, and of over 200, they found all but one. And we assume that one was someone who registered online and never provided the data that they needed to provide. So you are correct. The data in the state, the signatures in the state of Alaska system are excellent.
Thank you for that. That's a helpful reference point. And, you know, I think often vote by mail, vote at home is sort of seen through a lens of possible partisan or political advantage or concern. And I want to put on the record a study from the Stanford Democracy and Polarization Lab within the Institute for Economic Policy Research that was published April 15, 2020. It's titled The Neutral Partisan Effects of Vote by Mail, Evidence from County Level Rollout. And it effectively compared the political and partisan results of elections in different counties that administered a sort of county by county rollout before and after vote by mail rollout, and basically looked to see whether certain political parties or candidates of those parties were advantaged or disadvantaged through the before and after of vote by mail administration. And the answer was turnout increased, but there was not any partisan advantage to one party or the other. I think that's sort of a helpful reference point and study for the committee and for Alaskans to keep in mind. It was my intent to wrap things up by 11:30, and we're right at that timing. So I'm going to thank you, Ms. Jones, for making the time and being able to present today. And I also want to thank Sophia and Madison for their patience and gymnastics and making this hearing a possibility with some technical problems on the front end. That's going to conclude our business for today. I think through the course of the year, we may see or hear more on the subject as the committee continues to consider elections-related issues. But at 11:31, I'm going to adjourn this meeting, and have a good day, everybody.